Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. My name is Jason Lewis, and I'm your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Thank you for joining us today for the show that is shaping the way that the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. First, I want to thank our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by OneCause, leader in online, mobile, and virtual fundraising software. OneCause supports over 6,000 nonprofits to reach more and raise more with innovative solutions. You can visit their virtual fundraising resource center at www.onecause.com. I also want to tell you about what's coming up in July. Our team at Responsive want to invite you to participate in 6 hours of online CFRE-approved training. I am talking about a soup-to-nuts fundraising philosophy that will ensure your organization is ready for the road ahead. No one on the planet is going to offer you tools as researched, as tested, and as sustainable as our four frameworks. If you'd like more information about partnering with OneCause, or more information about our upcoming webinar series, look for information in the show notes. After you do, shoot me an email and let me know that you did. Now let's introduce today's guest. We have a second panel to talk about the 6-9 gift, what we might would call the gift rejection scenario that we talked about with our panel, with a separate panel earlier this week. And we've got some folks, not back, but a different group today to kind of continue that discussion. I have not enlightened this group on all the thoughts that I have not enlightened them on what everyone thought about it earlier this week. And so hopefully we'll get some really good new thoughts into the conversation. But before we dive into that, would you all mind just introducing yourself? Lisa, we'll start with you.
Thank you, Jason. I really appreciate you inviting me to join the podcast today and having our voices be heard. I am the Director of Major Gifts for Martin Luther King Community Health Foundation for Martin Luther King Community Hospital, and I am responsible for the strategic direction and management of key donors and fundraising initiatives essential to developing and expanding and stewarding major philanthropic support for the hospital. I've been in the nonprofit sector for 12 years, and I currently sit on the board for the Association of Fundraising Professionals of Greater Los Angeles, and I also chair the IDEA Committee, which is the Inclusion, Diversity, Equity, and Access Committee, and I also sit on another board called Connexion, which is a nonprofit that supports small businesses in South LA with access to capital, technical assistance, and resources. I am from South LA, and I'm definitely been excited to really share my fundraising skills with for my community. And our hospital is a young hospital. It's kind of what I call the second iteration of the original hospital that was there after the uprising, the Watts riots, which it seems very timely for the current climate that we're in. But it is our hospital is all about providing a compassionate, collaborative, quality care and to improve the health of South LA. It is a safety net hospital, and we are also an all-digital hospital, and we serve a large community that has heard a narrative that no one cares for them, and we have changed that narrative to one that is a community of health and wellness. And so I'm happy to be a part of the conversation today. Thank you.
Hi there. I'm Jason. Yeah, I'm calling in from the UK today. Thanks very much for having me. And currently I'm a founder of an organization called Pyro Talks. And the aim of that organization is to provide the fundraising sector specifically with interdisciplinary knowledge. So courses on finance, and emotional intelligence, and actually ethics and reputational risk. And we've just recently started out a new type of conference called a nano conference. So it'd be interesting to check that out. I'm also a consulting partner for BWF Europe, whose main office is in the US. So I've been on a number of projects with a number of firms in the past on due diligence, ethics and reputational risk, picking apart due diligence procedures, trying to improve them. I've been involved with a few situations which really highlight the importance of a proper ethics and reputational risk procedure. On top of that, I am a committee member of the Research and Fundraising Committee for the Institute of Fundraising. And, you know, that's about promoting best practice in the research and analytics profession. I'm also a trustee of a foundation called the Foundation for Developing Compassion and Wisdom, which is based in the US. And they had a great success with a course called 16 Guidelines to a Happy Life. It was translated to over 20 countries, out in 20 countries. And again, I guess that follows this theme of ethics, integrity, and so forth, amongst other roles like director of fundraising. So hopefully I've got a bit of a different perspective to offer today. So thanks for having me.
Thank you so much, Jason. My name's Sam LaPrade, and I'm from Ottawa, Canada. I've been a fundraiser for about 30 years. I've been a frontline fundraiser for the majority of that time and became a consultant, excuse me, in 2009. And I really focus on analytics is a big focus of my work, but I love to coach fundraisers. I love to do relationship building and really focus on stewardship. I'm also an international speaker. I also host a radio show called An Hour to Give in a beautiful Halifax, Canada, as well as Ottawa, Canada. And I'm really happy to be here today.
Great. Hi, everybody. I am Tarian Koshy. I work at Des Moines Performing Arts on the fundraising team here. Also, an advisory member for Regari, the fundraising think tank, and happy to be here.
Yeah. So what we're talking about, and as I shared with all of you, and as our listeners are aware, this is the second round on this panel discussion. We're talking about this sort of as a case study in a panel discussion. Rapper 6ix9ine had donated a $200,000 gift to Share Our Strength to their No Kid Hungry campaign, and Share Our Strength decided to decline that gift or reject that gift, and he subsequently, the rapper subsequently, referred to, called the decision cruel on Instagram. And so I posted, an inquiry on LinkedIn and said, hey, let's get some fundraising professionals in the room, in the virtual room, and have a conversation about this. And, what are the thoughts about the efficacy of rejecting a gift? And, perhaps talk about gift acceptance policies. All of us in this room today have received gifts of significance, perhaps much larger, certainly much larger than even $200,000. And sometimes they come with strings attached of various sorts. So Lisa, what's your thoughts on that?
Oh, well, when I first heard about the gift, I was like, oh, that's interesting, because I, for whatever reason, have been following what's, you know, you just hear ever so often what's going on with Tekashi and his 6ix9ine and his, you know, his whole history where he's been in jail and all of that. I was like, that's very interesting. And the first thought was it's a publicity stunt. That was the first thing that came to my mind. But I feel that they did a really good job, because, you know, when you think about when you receive gifts, it is all about what does this align with our morals and values? Does this align with, you know, what we are about? And if it doesn't, then that's a clear sign that you need to stay away from that. And, you know, he may have felt that it was cruel, but, you know, you cannot jeopardize your nonprofit status and take a gift that is not going to, you know, move your cause or your organization along. And so, yeah, my immediate thought was that was a good decision that they made. And I would like to think that they, you know, discussed with him why. And that is why we have gift of acceptance policies, so that, you know, it is a very polite way of sharing with that particular, you know, donor why you're defining a gift. And I think it's imperative that you have one. You should have one. Some folks even put it on their website so that there will be no qualms about what is accepted and what isn't by the time, you know, you're in talks about what that gift might look like. And so I thought it was a good move on their part.
How about you chime in here?
Yeah, when I first read about this, my mind jumped from one side to the other. And I've been involved with a number of panels where I've accepted quite bigger gifts than this from, say, gambling firms. And the money has been accepted, and mainly because the money was coming from an alumnus of the university and the fund was named in a specific way and for a specific person, specific purpose, away from what you might call encouraging gambling behavior, increasing access to education and so forth. So, you know, we kind of felt like sometimes it's okay to accept money which might have come from a difficult origin. And from that perspective, you know, I kind of think, well, if the money has been earned through, you might say, negative means, surely then let's put the money to good use. You know, a pool of water is a pool of water, is it not? And that's the kind of thoughts I was having when I first read about this. But when I went to look at his past and his record, I found my mind switching quite quickly, because they just felt something wrong with given what he's been accused of and so forth. You know, the nature of the organization, it really failed to contradict that mission. So I kind of had the thought, you know, is it virtue if by any means? So just because we accept the money, you know, are we really doing good? Are we encouraging behavior? And then it went back again, because my last thought was, well, then at what point do you give someone a chance? At what point do you become part of someone's positive success story? You know, this rapper might want to really start to do good in the world, and this is where he starts. How do we then become part of that? Could they have built in this gift into that kind of narrative that he was trying to change his ways, you know, and this charity was going to work with him to do just that? So I've been really jumping around on this one. So I'm really interested to hear everyone else's thoughts too.
Well, certainly, yeah, I have been faced with these very challenging circumstances. But when you break it down as to why an organization, in my mind, why an organization is around to do good work with bad money, is certainly not the premise of nonprofits in my mind. I felt really, really strongly this was the right decision that they've made. And I'll tell you, for every decision that's made like this, there are 10 that don't have the courage to make a decision like this. So I feel very, very strongly that we all need to look at those gift acceptance policies, as we heard from Lisa. I'm heartbroken when I work with new clients and they tell me they don't have a gift acceptance policy, or they have one and they need to sort of dust it off. That always is really hard for me to hear. One of the very first things I do is work with the board and try and get that gift acceptance policy, for this very reason, is you don't want anything to sort of be muddy. This is a really clear case of values not aligning. And if there's going to be a sector in this world we're living in, especially right now, that has principles and values, it needs to be the nonprofit sector. So in my mind, when I think of sort of these opportunities to make a stand like this, I think it also sends a really strong message to those donors that give for the right reason, and give for the reasons that you know, that really philanthropy is built on. This isn't philanthropy, in my mind. This story we're discussing, you know, is basically throwing money at a problem that you know, that he's created himself, and it you know, that's how I see it. I don't see this as philanthropy.
So I'm going to take I'm going to have a different conclusion than everyone else. And I'm going to start from a principle perspective and then lead into the practice of this particular instance, which I believe was completely inappropriate. And it was wrong for them to refuse this gift. So beginning from a principal perspective, gift acceptance policies should not, ought not, be donor acceptance policies. Gift acceptance policies, from my perspective, is an opportunity for the institution to express how gifts are to be conveyed from the donor to the organization. And it outlines what gifts are acceptable and what gifts are not acceptable. Donor access to beneficiaries notwithstanding, which I think is a difficult and thorny issue, and each organization needs to sort that out on its own. So I want to separate that issue out. The challenge of what these organizations are doing is applying donor acceptance policies to particular people without doing due diligence across the donor base, meaning there are donors like 6ix9ine who are public about their willingness to make a gift. There are other people potentially in every single donor file in the United States, probably internationally as well, that include people of similar moral or principled problematic sources. So the gift acceptance policy should certainly exclude gifts that are stolen. But even then, you know, BASF had ties to Nazi Germany. So are they, where is the fruit of the poisonous tree that occurs there? The question then is, are we doing the due diligence to screen every donor to determine, are they a felon? Have they committed certain crimes? What is their intention with their philanthropy? And what intentions then do we find as a nonprofit acceptable, and which intentions do we not find acceptable? I, for example, I'm not an avid gambler, but I have been to Vegas, I have gambled, I have then taken those winnings, I have donated those winnings. In some instances, those are ill-gotten gains to some people. Some people view that gift as inappropriate based on its source. I completely understand that, and I would direct that gift to somewhere else. I do believe that that is greenwashing of my gift, and it's my decision to greenwash it. With regard to this particular individual and No Kids Hungry, I believe that they made the decision in order for publicity, in order to be able to say no. And the reason I believe that is because at the exact same time as they refused a gift from 6ix9ine and publicly said no to that gift, they were already accepting and planning to accept a gift from Robert Kraft. So the argument against Daniel Hernandez, which is 6ix9ine's actual name, is that he was in a video with a child that resulted in that portrayed him and her in an inappropriate way. He was accused and charged with a felony. How those felony charges played out is not important. The point is that there was a felony associated with that. Robert Kraft, using the logo of No Kids Hungry, donated his Super Bowl ring. Robert Kraft is on video participating in what Florida authorities call an accessory to human trafficking. They are pushing for a felony charge. Robert Kraft has way more money than Daniel Hernandez does, and a different set of legal opportunities than he does. So whether or not that charge sticks, I don't know. But No Kids Hungry said nothing about their morals and values when it came to Robert Kraft versus 6ix9ine. So I believe that in the instance of this refusal, it was inconsistently applied and inappropriately applied. Whereas the dollars, if we think that kids are hungry and we need to feed them, then we should accept the money from Robert Kraft and 6ix9ine. If we have a morals and values gate across what we say who can give, then neither of those gifts should be accepted.
So what you're saying, Chirin, and I think you made a really good point, is that basically it was going to be the lesser of two evils there, because both men, you know, were charged, you know, with human trafficking, the other, sexual encounters with children. And so it's the lesser of two evils. So how do you juggle that? Again, I think, you know, I look at the gift acceptance policy as like a moral document. That is kind of like your compass. And I understand what you're saying about, you know, a donor not making it be about the actual gift, or not making it be about the actual, not the gift, the actual donor. But then it's like, when does the moral, the mission and values of the organization come into play. Because with Daniel Hernandez, it was more than that. He has so many gang ties. People are after him. There's just so many things going on in his life. I mean, I would just think, you know, on just a level of, again, following his story and knowing it from the very beginning, that that would be something where you would really, as a board member, I would really, you know, have a problem with that, with you accepting a gift based on all of the things that he's been involved in. It's not just one, two, or three things. It's more than that. I mean, he recently had to move from his home because someone was trying to kill him. So there's just so many things that I think there's layers there. I do get what you're saying about the fact that we need to base it on the gift, but then how are we doing our due diligence as an organization? How are we, what is that compass, and who is to tell us what that is? You know, when do we give them a chance? When do we give these donors a chance? I mean, it's just like the very well-known basketball franchisee owner, you know, who, you know, spouted off racial slurs, and a lot of people in LA have gotten money from them. Do you then, after years, return the money? I see where you're going with this. Then it's like it turns into a different conversation. It's like, you know, or like, for example, you know, Walmart. You know, a lot of organizations have received money from Walmart, but then their employee practices, you know, a while back weren't the best, and especially towards people of color. So do we stop accepting gifts? You know, should we stop accepting gifts from them, or should we accept them based on that and based on what our mission and values are? I mean, I think you have I understand your argument, but then it's like, how do you put safeguards up? When do you make those right decisions? That's what I'm trying to understand.
So I think that's right, Lisa. And I think the point is that it needs to be a board decision to understand where the safeguards are. But the simple answer is that whatever is decided needs to be consistently applied. So if we believe that felons can't make gifts, and let's be clear, if we say that felons can't make gifts, we're not saying felons can't make gifts to No Kids Hungry or to a hunger organization. We're basically saying felons can't make gifts. I have a serious problem with that, the way that systemic injustice occurs in this country. Yes. So I would not be okay with a board who made that statement. But bracketing that question, if it's consistently applied, that would mean that we are looking through our database and making sure that we are not accepting gifts from felons, period, end of story. Mm-hmm. And if we find that we have inadvertently accepted a gift from a felon, that we are returning it. That's what morality requires. Your Walmart example is an outstanding one. We have many organizations who say that we won't accept gifts from Walmart directly or some other organization that participates in racism or sexism or some active environmental problems or drug opioid addiction, these problems that we believe are antithetical to our missions and values. Those statements are fine. I believe those statements are appropriate and good as safeguards. However, they are inconsistently applied when you accept index funds that also include the value of that stock. So, for example, right, if you say no to Sackler money, but you say yes to an index fund that has Johnson & Johnson money, I have a problem with that. Johnson & Johnson has actually been charged with the largest opioid conviction. So if you believe that you won't take opioid money, then saying no to Sackler is not just enough. You have to go all the way. And I think the problem is that a lot of times this is underthought, and we just say, well, you know, vaguely it's important for us to be consistent with our mission, but we're not willing to do the hard work of thinking through what are the implications of this, and are we really okay with the implications of this moving forward?
Can I just add a bit on that consistency thought there? I'm kind of trying to understand the perspective of why necessarily consistency is important, maybe more as a devil advocate's thought on this, because, you know, all these gifts arise in unique circumstances, don't they? And in some ways, part of a gift acceptance policy of accepting or rejecting donations is to try and understand what the financial impact might be of a reputation damage, if you like. So, for example, Oxfam, when they had this the bigger scandal recently, you know, they lost 7,000 donors and millions of pounds of funding. So if this charity was thinking of 6ix9ine and thinking tactically because they had another gift on the table that they knew about, why would that necessarily be a wrong application of a due diligence procedure? Because their job is to, in a way, protect the reputation to ensure maximum income of funds. And, you know, so why does consistency have to be necessarily applied for it to be a correct decision? I would be interested to know.
Well, Jason, I would say that in this instance, the inconsistency smacks of some other influence that's occurring, that it's easier and more culturally acceptable to take a gift from someone named Robert Kraft than it is to take a gift from a rapper named 6ix9ine or Daniel Hernandez. And the inconsistency introduces a ton of bias and systemic injustice. So if you get to say that here's our mission and values and we just get to interpret that however we want in whatever circumstance, then I don't think that's actually a moral statement. That's just us saying willy-nilly, when we feel like it, we'll do what we want and work our way through the checking off the box of a gift acceptance policy. I'm a huge proponent of gift acceptance policies. I think they are important. And as Lisa mentions, I think they should be actual safeguards, but they should be applied consistently regardless of race or economic factors or any other irrelevant element to the gift that's being transacted, which is why I think it should be a gift acceptance policy, not a donor acceptance policy. Because if you say, well, we're not going to accept money from this type of person, I think you open up a lot of doors that are not okay.
Right. And I would have loved to have been in the room when, you know, Daniel's were, you know, speaking to No Kid Hungry, because I would love to understand what that conversation was. Because if we're talking about bias, if he was just a rapper, right, that would be a different conversation. But he's not only a felon, there's just so many other things that has happened. Sure. That really prevents me from, you know, kind of swallowing that down. It would be different if he was, you know, just say someone like, I don't know, Roddy Ricch, and, you know, he comes from the community and it makes sense that he gave, you know, say he gave a gift to Martin Luther King. That would make sense. He hasn't been in the news like 6ix9ine. So to me, that there is a difference there. And I do feel like I understand that there is need for consistency in terms of using the gift acceptance policy. But as Jason said, it's hard because there's unique circumstances for different gifts. And sometimes, you know, there may be some different restrictions that go with that. I'm even thinking about there's an aerialist pole company out here that I have never been able to work with because of the stigma of what some people view it as a stripper pole. You know, they call it aerialist pole, but this is a company that is popular, that they have a lot of money, and all they want to do is give back, and they can't find not one nonprofit organization to work with them because of that stigma. So then we can, you know, look at that. You know, I think. It's more than just one way to answer the question. I don't have all those answers, but I do think that, again, it has to be unique and you have to do your research. And in this case, I don't know. I felt like I know a lot about Tekashi to then say, you know what, this may not be the best route. Maybe what they could do is, you know, continue the conversation and see where it leads. But I just feel like there's just no one way to answer this question.
Can I just ask about when we think about Robert Kraft, he faces the charges. Has he been prosecuted yet?
He has not been there. His lawyers are arguing that he should not be charged in this way for this manner.
Right. So my point being is that we see 6ix9ine has not only faced the charges, been prosecuted, been through that piece. You know, we have to let the justice system do their due diligence on the charges that are faced by people. I don't see these two as being in the same bucket, if you will.
And just to add on that, I think I do like the distinction between the idea of a donor acceptance policy versus a gift acceptance policy. I'm just reflecting mm-hmm. that, but I can't seem to distinguish the two. You know, if we put the emphasis on gift acceptance policy, what we're kind of saying is we're putting the emphasis on the money. And if we're just thinking of the money alone, the question then is the money going to be useful? Yes or no? In some ways, then at that point, you don't take into account where the money's come from. You know, in other words, the donor. So I think really all gift acceptance policies really is a donor acceptance policy as well. I mean, we do like to talk about a lot in philanthropy how big gifts in a way are like partnership gifts, you know. And so I think they do have to consider a lot more nuances than necessarily, you know, what might first appear. And I think in unique circumstances too, if there is another gift on the table, which is bigger, let's say, and who knows, if you were to accept one, you might lose the other, then mm-hmm. I think that's a valid thought pattern to have. But I do definitely take the point about could the inconsistency expose a discrimination and prejudice? I mean, that's something I won't be able to answer unless I was sat around the table with them.
Right.
And so, one of the questions that was asked earlier this week, we'll start with Lisa. Let's see if you'll see what your thoughts on this. One of the questions that was sort of posed earlier this week with the other panel is where does the money go otherwise? So do we have an obligation as fundraisers or in the philanthropic community, do we have an obligation in some way or another to let this money go somewhere? And so who has the obligation? So for example, your organization, Lisa, mm-hmm. would your organization receive this gift? Or Cheerion, would your organization receive this gift? And assuming there were no strings attached, you don't have to put his name on the side of your building or anything like that. But, you know, do we have an obligation to let people give away their monetary resources? Is that an obligation that we have regardless of who they necessarily are? Because we have a rich history. I mean, rich is probably the wrong word, but we have a very deep, long history in philanthropy of receiving money from people who at times were certainly viewed in society as less than mm-hmm. The ideal people.
Right. I mean, I feel like we have an obligation to the organization. I don't know if I have an obligation to, you know, people that want to donate the money and help them and then determine where they're going to put these resources at if it's not something that our organization is able to handle, whether that's PR wise, whether that's legal wise or the like. I feel that, you know, in the instance of this particular gift, we would probably not be able to accept it. And I'll say for many reasons. And the first one is optics, because for us, we have been in a position where for so long, the narrative has been that, you know, I mean, South LA, there's a stigma around that. And it's always been about gangs and, you know, poor people and all of that. And that's not the narrative that we're kicking anymore. We are saying, no, we are giving quality, compassionate care. And we want you to stand with us, you know, as we create a community that's rooted in health and wellness. Would 6ix9ine's gift add to that in terms of monetary wise? Absolutely. But we're not just thinking about that. It's very intentional. And I think it depends on the organization. Like, how do you approach your donors? How do you steward them? How do you approach the actual whole process, you know, of cultivating them and getting them to that point? I think that varies from organization to organization. And I don't think that it would be my responsibility. My responsibility is to understand, you know, where would the money go? Understand who is it coming from? How is it going to impact the community in the right way? And how is it setting up a platform for the future? And, you know, we probably wouldn't be in the position to accept a gift like this, unfortunately. And it's not because of of, you know, the color of his skin or anything like that. It's just because our organization is not going to be able to handle what may come from this, the backlash that may come from this. We have other things to worry about. The fact that diabetes is 3 times the state rate in South LA, the fact that we have a 1,200 doctor physician gap, you know, those are the things that we need to focus on. And even in my own life, I don't want any drama. That sounds like a lot of drama. You know, that just sounds like a lot of drama. We all know about, you know, some high maintenance gifts. So that's right. Really,
yeah. That's the choose your battles argument. I think we can all side with that. Who else has a thought on that? Who would actually consider taking this gift?
Well, obviously we would consider taking it. I don't want to speak for our board, but I do want to just elevate this above a personal institutional decision to say that organizations, when crafting gift acceptance policies, need to understand the ramifications of how to make the decision. And it can't just be, we don't feel like it, or it's too hard for us to do the right thing. So I would caution organizations in particular about laying out rules in their gift acceptance policy, particularly about felony charges. I think you need to be more in depth about that. To Sam's point, this person, 6ix9ine, was charged with a felony. I think there's a real difference with the way that Robert Kraft's legal team is addressing that. I don't think those situations are different. So the accusation, the question is not whether both of these people did what they were accused of doing. And so when organizations are thinking through whether to accept a gift, the question really needs to be, how can we reduce bias and influence into these decisions that are irrelevant to the consideration of whether the gift is appropriate? Because once we set up these guardrails willy-nilly, and each organization does so, it structurally excludes vast numbers of people from philanthropy. And there are a lot of people in this country that have gang ties or have gang relationships, who have criminal past, and they should not be structurally excluded from philanthropy. I understand that there are reasons for limiting access, and for, you know, that there are PR risks and all of these things. But when we think about what is right to do, structurally excluding people from giving, I think, is wrong. And so the more that we can do as an industry, as a sector, to really critically think through how our policies affect the not just our existing donors, but the entire landscape of donors in the country or internationally, whatever, I think is the most important thing we need to focus on.
Yeah. And I've been thinking about thoughts like that too. How do you improve due diligence process in an organization? It's a culture, really. I mean, first of all, I really like the term that Lisa made about backlash. I do think that's important, and it is part of a donation acceptance policy, because you're protecting the reputation in a way to protect future funds, in other words, the survival of the organization. So I think backlash should be included. But then how do you ensure, if you like, you know, a more consistent, robust process? And one of the things I've advised organizations to do is to kind of develop a case law. So just like in, you know, law as it's practiced, can you build an internal case law so that decisions, the reasoning for decisions, are made, recorded, and they are referred to when any new gift comes up? And this came about, this idea, because there were some organizations I worked with and some senior individuals, they were kind of given the decision to make as part of a committee, and they felt they just didn't have the expertise or knowledge, or they felt fearful of accepting or rejecting the gift. And that's where we come up with the idea of developing this kind of case law through an institution. So it acts like a spine that goes through the due diligence procedure. And I think that helps to give people confidence and an awareness of where their decisions are coming from, and hopefully does help to reduce bias. Because then if a gift of similar nature has been accepted in the past, you have to really dig into the reasons why. And unless it's very unique circumstances, you kind of ought to take the gift.
I, sorry, can I just step in for a second in terms of board relations, in terms of this, you know, we think about gift acceptance policies, we think about empowering nonprofit leaders to sort of move this forward. And, you know, one thing I see consistently, unfortunately, and maybe this is just Canada, I don't think so, but certainly is that nonprofit boards tend not to be sort of courageous in this way. They tend to, you know, be so nervous about the public backlash. Mm-hmm. They tend to, you know, not be, feel like they're secure in these decisions. I mean, you think about trying to get a board together to decide what they want to eat for lunch. You know, and I mean that lovingly. I mean, it can be very, very challenging to try and get a team, a group of people that come with all these diverse backgrounds. I just don't know if the nonprofit leaders are given sort of that that space, if you will, to bring these type of issues forward to boards. They tend to just, you know, in many ways be on there for various reasons. And I'll argue that not everybody's on a board for the right reasons. So to bring them really challenging decisions like this, I think we've got a lot of work to do on the board side.
And that's why this idea of case law is kind of adventitious in a way, for exactly that reason, for people, you know, they're on the board for different reasons and they convene intermittently often. So yeah, they've almost become, they're not practiced in making these decisions, are they? So yeah, that's a really interesting point.
Yeah, and I was going to say that, you know, this is, when I think about when I came into fundraising back in 2007, I felt like that was the cusp where traditional fundraising was starting to kind of like phase out, and this, what I call new school of fundraising, meaning where we can create a culture that would be, you know, would not structurally exclude, you know, people, you know, from making these types of gifts. And I think it's more a systemic thing. We know that our sector is rather elitist. I mean, that is point blank, period. And the thing is, it's like you, it's a changing of cultures. It's the changing of thought. I mean, I even think about some YouTubers that have reached out and wanting to donate, but because of whatever it is that they are associated with, you know, not being able to accept gifts. And I think, you know, in those circumstances, I do think that these are the times where you need to make the decision as to, you know, how can we make make room for people like these who are just, you know, trying to do something good. But I think it is really going to be, it has to be a collective thing where people are coming together and saying, you know what, we're going to change this culture so that it is inclusive of people and what they want to bring to the table.
So one of the other things, Lindsay was in our group earlier this week, and one of the things that she asked, she said, what if it was $1,000 gift? It wasn't a $200,000 gift. I think, Cheerion, you were sort of alluding to this. But what those of you who have read my stuff and listened to the podcast a couple of times, you know that I am of the opinion that fundraising in many ways, and this is sort of the brass tacks and sort of the practicality of how we do fundraising as it applies to this case. I think that in many ways, efficiency has sort of run amok in fundraising. And we create so much volume of activity that we can't, therefore, pay attention to or police or even screen the volume of contributions that we're receiving. And so as it applies to the contribution that Lindsay was referring to on the last panel, you know, if it was $1,000 and it came through a direct mail program, it's very unlikely that the contribution would have even hit anybody's radar, because oftentimes $1,000 gift doesn't actually interact with a human being in some of these very large institutions. It just simply gets automated. You know, it's an automated response process, and nobody would ever know the difference. And I even posed the question to the group, what if we found out that 6ix9ine had actually made $1,000 gifts 6 months earlier of $1,000, and that this actually was a subsequent gift that they were turning away? That would make for quite a messy predicament. And we all know in fundraising that oftentimes those very preliminary gifts, say that $1,000 gift that oftentimes goes unnoticed, is that trust building gift that says, okay, these people know how to, you know, receive the gift, and it's that trust building gift. And oftentimes a very much, you know, a significant gift of say $200,000 is what comes later. So let's talk, as we wrap up this conversation, let's talk about some of the, just the practical, is this as much a problem of just the way that we do fundraising as much as it is the error of ways, you know, the flaws in these particular donors that we're talking about.
I think the landscape needs to change in terms of the way that we approach fundraising. I mean, I think you know that more than ever with the business that you've created, the approach needs to be different. I think we need to look at it through different eyes. And I do appreciate Sharon for really bringing it up in a way where, you know, I can really understand and see, you know, where we're either, you know, kind of weigh the options. And I feel like I'm kind of in the middle. It's one of those things where it's, you know, it has, I think it has to be, it's a unique situation, and it has to be weighed out case by case at this point, because, you know, as we, you know, see the wealth now move over to the younger generation, there are going to be different things that we will encounter. And different gifts that come up. And I don't think that one gift policy will be able to cover all of those things. And so I just think we have to be prepared and understand. Again, it just comes down to what we're willing to accept and not accept.
Yeah. And I like to see the professionalization of ethics and risk in the organization develop even more. You know, why can't there be training on making decisions like this? You know, surely at some point there ought to be, which helps train boards into making more informed decisions. And if anyone studied philosophy at university and done an ethics module, you know, of course, you know, it's completely circumstantial ethics, ethical decisions. And often it's about intention, you know, as to whether an act is deemed good or bad. And yeah, I mean, going back to what you said, Jason, about the $1,000 versus the $200,000, I think that's a really interesting one. And it exposes a real challenging question, doesn't it? But in some ways, that is the way the institution's set up. And that means that people can give at any level they like in some ways without consequence. But a $200,000 one seems to me like a statement. And that's what they've got to be aware of. With all these nuances that we need training into our organizations, I think.
And let's be clear, Jason. I think the important piece is that 6ix9ine wanted to make a point, right? This was about him and about publicity. And so had he quietly given $200,000, I don't know that No Kids Hungry would have said no. So there's an element of that as well. I'm not generally a fan of case-by-case analysis. I do think that organizations can have different gift acceptance policies based upon a coherent framework. But I do think that efficiency has sort of run amok. For some organizations, $1,000 is a major gift. And I want to say that, you know, if the American Lung Cancer Association or similar organization was able to receive a $1 billion gift from RJ Reynolds, the tobacco company, but that gift would end lung cancer, it would cure lung cancer, they would be morally obligated to take that gift. So there is an element of this utilitarian ethic that I think is important, because the greater good is ending lung cancer in that instance. Now, I don't think we need to extrapolate out all of the nuances of that example and play it out, because that's not realistic. But the point is that as Jason Briggs mentioned, we definitely need a better understanding of ethics and how ethics interact with our policies. And to Sam's point, our boards need to be better trained, because these are the types of decisions that will become more pronounced, more difficult, more controversial, and more will happen more often over the course of the coming decades. So substantial training on the part of boards and of fundraisers and really good thinking is essential for our sector moving forward.
Well, it has certainly been a pleasure to have all of you on here, and I promise to keep us at about 45 minutes. We usually lose some of our listeners. The commute is over with, or they've sort of given up on us. It has been a pleasure. You guys really stirred it up today. You went in a different direction than our panel went earlier this week. I look forward to hearing your feedback to theirs and their feedback to yours. And you're all welcome back. Lisa and Jason, you're both new voices on the podcast, and you are certainly welcome back to come back and talk about whatever you'd like to as it relates to fundraising. And then Cheering and Sam, it's been a delight to have you back You've been on here before and you're always welcome back as well. Before I let you all go, would you mind just letting people know, Lisa, Jason, Cheerion, and Sam, how can people reach out to you if they've heard something you've said and they're saying, I want to reach out to that person. I want to continue the conversation. I want to provide some feedback. How would you suggest that they do that?
Oh, yes, absolutely. You can reach out to us via our website, www.mlk-chf.org. And, you know, there's a ton of information and videos about the good work that we're doing, the very critical work that we're doing in South LA. So please come check us out and learn more about us.
I think for myself, just LinkedIn. I have my name on LinkedIn as Jason J. Briggs, because there's so many Jason Briggses. And this is the only way you can easily find me. So if you just search for me on LinkedIn, you'll be able to connect that way.
And to find me, I'm Sam LaPrade, and you can find me at samlaprade.com or Griffin Fundraising. And of course, LinkedIn, Twitter, I'm there for the party.
I'm Cheerion. I work at Des Moines Performing Arts at dmpa.org, and you can follow them on social as well. They're doing some cool things as a team when we can't be in person. And then personally, I'm on Twitter at Cheerion_Koshy. There are very few of us, and also on LinkedIn.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.